I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
More on Top Gear's return later as we discuss Amazon's big bet on UK streaming video. Welcome to Text Message. I'm Nate Langson.
And I'm Ian Morris.
And we're back with Mr. Ian. A few weeks of Morris-free recording, which has been a terrible shame. I've been miserable.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry to hear that, mate. I'm sorry. There's been a few things that have happened, haven't there, that have prevented us from adequately podding together. Not the least of which, you were too busy last week and I was on my deathbed.
Well, we're going to start with the nutritious news of Windows 10. Now, this week is sort of the end of the first full week of us having Windows on sale. We might be just a day or so over or a day or so behind, depending on whereabouts you are in the world.
I bet they haven't sold a single copy.
Well, they've been very keen to give them away for free. And
yes,
we wanted
and
to talk
give it away a lot.
Yeah, give it away now. Listen to some Chili Peppers on their new Groove music service, I sense. So we wanted to talk a bit about the launch of Windows 10, a little bit about what we think of it so far, and a few sort of nuggets of news and information about the OS that I think are interesting. And we'll start with talking about the fact that no one seems to have come out with a definitive reason why we have Windows 10 and not Windows 9. Now, I posed a challenge to Ian to find out why this was, but in the gap between asking him and recording, I looked into it myself anyway. And there are a number of reasons that people have given for why Windows 10 is called Windows 10 and not Windows 9.
I bet 9. Some of them are a pack of lies.
Well, the most common one seems to be that even if it was called Windows 9, that still wouldn't be accurate, because if you actually count the number of Windowses that have been released since the 80s, the number has been in double digits for quite a long time. Mm. If you think about things like, you know, the various NT versions and XP, this Windows 8, and then there was Windows 8.1, there was, you know, ME 2000, all these different editions. There are several dozen in total. So the fact is that it would have been higher than 10 if they'd have gone for an accurate number for major consumer releases alone. The other fact is that a lot of the Windows versions, even up to Windows 8, were not internally at Microsoft referred to, or at least categorized as being Windows 8, because they were categorized by their NT version number, which is the technology that Windows is built on. And so Windows 8 was actually NT version 6.4. It might be 6.3.
Right, no, it's 6.4.
Yeah, now, so the big change is that you know, obviously that number was lower than 8, and the real number of consumer releases would have been higher than 10. And the other factor is they probably just wanted something that puts them on par with OS 10, not wanting to be one number behind Mac, because it's the kind of thing Apple would, you know, kind of take the piss out of in some advert. And they've also renamed the NT release number to be the same as the consumer release number. So this is NT version 10, and it hasn't matched the Windows release number since NT 4, which was the fourth release. So if anything, they've gone it's a long-winded way of going back to what they did in the early 90s, and it kind of averages out the lower NT release number and the higher consumer version count and settled on 10. That's what an hour and a half of digging this afternoon taught me anyway.
I think that sounds like the most plausible explanation, really. Like, there was a lot of guff written about the fact that they were trying to avoid version number confusion. having Windows 9 would have given coders problems with where they'd used a bit of code to differentiate a different version of Windows. But that's just simple. I'm pretty sure that almost no coders would have used that method. I mean, perhaps a very small number would. But like you say, most Windows version numbers have been completely different, you know, in terms of what they actually are. So most coders would probably stick to that, I would have thought, but who knows?
Yes. So I think that if you're ever in a conversation, dear listener, perhaps you've just taken a swig of beer, maybe a bite from a crisp. Maybe you've just got out of bed and your partner says, why isn't it called Windows 9 if it's an upgrade from Windows 8? You can turn to them, put down your beer, put that crisp away, look your spouse in the eye and say, it's because the internal version was a lower number than 8, and the external release number of Windows's was higher. 10 is nicely in the middle, and that's about as good as you're going to get. Anyway, now we've solved that conundrum, worthy of being at the end of Countdown. Let's move on to the release. It seems to have gone quite well so far.
Yeah.
Hasn't been any major complaints. It hasn't been haven't been gangs of people in the street with pitchforks and flames. It seems to have rolled out as intended. People seem to like it. It was difficult not to like it if you were already using and had got used to Windows 8. But there hasn't been any kind of new Microsoft OS scale kind of backlash. And we despise this new design. We despise this. They seem to have hit a lot of nails on the head and people seem happy. I think that it might have been Peter Bright on Ars Technica that said this is basically the best version of Windows ever released, as long as you don't count the bugs that are currently being worked on being fixed. And I have to say, I've been using Windows 8 for a while and found the jump to Windows 10 was just an absolute breath of fresh air in all the right ways. I recently replaced the SSD and RAM in my girlfriend's laptop and put her on Windows 10 instead of Windows 7. And she absolutely loves it. Seems to think that it's really great, faster, more responsive, which possibly might have something to do with the RAM and SSD that I put in there. But also just seems to love the UI and the way it's laid out. So, you know, they're hard cookies to please, the general public and the tech journalists. So
it is great. I mean, I've been using it through the beta and all of that. And it has been fairly painful at times. I put myself on the fast ring so I could see changes quickly, and I had a lot of blue screening. But then a couple of weeks ago, it just didn't update and then suddenly was rock solid. So at that point, I was like, they have finalized this, I believe. And it was very close to the release date, so it was always going to go that way. But it's been quite... Microsoft's a very different company now. It's definitely been a lot more open about the release of Windows 10, and it seems like they have listened to all of the criticism about Windows 8. And Windows 8 was never bad. I was using it for a long time, and I never had any problems with it. Honestly, I thought it was pretty good, and the start menu never bothered me. Frankly, I don't spend enough time in the start menu to really spend much time thinking about it.
There was a question that was asked of me, I think possibly by my brother a couple of days ago, Andy. And he said we were talking about whether Windows 10 was as significant to Microsoft and to its users as some previous releases. The example being the move to XP was memorably game changing as far as desktop usage goes. You know, it was an absolute
that was
sea change.
Different, though.
Yeah, it was, but it was I think we have to be relative to the era. You know, it was huge then. This is a very different era of Windows now. And relatively speaking, could they be compared? And the other one is, of course, Windows 7 after Vista. Now, I think that Windows 7... By the way, I've noticed something I do. I pose a question, then immediately answer it myself. Have you noticed I do that? Because I did the other day when I was editing the show on a plane.
Mate, we all love you just as you are.
Okay.
I have occasionally noticed that, but it's fine. You have the answer. You know, it's fine.
Okay. I've started, so I'll finish. Windows 7 did fix a lot of what was wrong with Windows Vista, but in a sense, they were quite similar In, you know, visual style and what have you.
Windows 7 wasn't really actually that much of a massive change. By the time everyone had upgraded their computers to make Vista work, which was, I mean, Vista was one of those things, because of the way it moved away, it moved into having accelerated graphics, you know, for the desktop, it meant that if you didn't have an up-to-date computer, it was just atrocious. And that hasn't happened since, because basically, GPUs are in everything now. I mean, even if you don't have a discrete graphics card, you've probably still got a CPU that does graphics. So there's never that problem these days. But back when Vista came out, a lot of people probably didn't have a graphics, or, you know, a very sophisticated graphics card. So that gave people huge amounts of problems with Vista that they didn't need to have, and people upgraded too quickly. And then when 7 came out, it was basically the same thing, slightly toned down, but with a few extra nice bits in. I loved 7, but Vista gets a lot of hate that it doesn't really deserve.
No, I think the hate was definitely justified at the beginning, and you know, we took great pleasure in an impartial way back when we worked together at CNET in pointing out all the many things that were wrong with Windows Vista. But realistically, by the end of its lifespan and on a fairly up-to-date machine, Vista was absolutely fine. And I agree with you that the jump into Windows 7 world was not, it was a moon hop. It wasn't a planetary relocation effort. Don't know where that metaphor came from. But I think this is, in a way, because it's a lot better than Windows 8, even at the end of Windows 8's lifespan. It brings back the much beloved start menu, but bakes into it a lot of what was actually quite good about the Windows 8 screen, such as, you know, the live tiles, which, although I didn't personally use, I think they are still a good idea if you are embedded in the Microsoft world. I'm tempted to put it on par with Windows XP, particularly when you factor in that it's being released for free, it's a service, not a product. When you factor in as well things like how it's tied up with Xbox and the gaming system, Cortana, I guess, is fairly interesting. I think it's probably the most significant since Windows XP.
Good. Well, I mean, it's certainly a rapid business change for Microsoft. I think in terms of significance, it will be very, very significant for them.
Yeah. All right. One more thing before we leave Windows 10 for the time being is, I thought we were in an interesting position to talk about how this compares with Mac OS 10, because the comparisons are inevitable for a number of reasons, but I think you may have a more interesting view on this than I do, in that you are still relatively a recent Mac convert. I've been a Mac user.
Yes, but I still don't own one, though, so I'm by no means an expert.
Okay, but you're a fan of the OS.
Yeah, I do. I mean, I don't know. OSs these days aren't what they used to be. It used to be that, you know, I mean, this is probably because I've changed a lot as well. You know, it used to be that I would sit down and I would spend hours and hours and hours customizing my computer. And now I don't do that. I can't be arsed. I haven't got the time. So now what I want to do is press the start button and type in what I want, you know, and then it comes up. And if I can do that on a Windows computer, that's fine. If I can do it on a Mac, that's also fine. Most of the stuff I do these days is based in the cloud anyway. So the OS for me has become semi-irrelevant. I have started gaming again a bit on the PC, which obviously, you know, means that I would never get a Mac as a desktop. That said, I don't actually see the point now of lugging around PCs as laptops. So I kind of feel like I might have got to the point where, in my mind at least, I'm a desktop PC user, and I get a MacBook Air to lug around because they're nice and small and, you know, and they do everything I would need. And, you know, I there's plenty of things I like about Mac OS. I love the fact they managed to get virtual desktops working pretty flawlessly, which is something that Windows still hasn't managed to do, because they've added it now into 10.
I think you mean multiple desktops.
I do. Sorry. Yes. What do I mean? Yeah. Well, yes. Whichever
you don't mean
thing.
A virtual machine. You mean...
No, I don't mean a virtual, I mean multiple desktops. But yeah, the thing is that they don't... I've got a multi-monitor setup, and on that, it's extremely confusing and doesn't work at all well. I think if you've got a single monitor on Windows, it works really well. But on a Mac, I've seen people use multi-monitors and multi-desktops with no problem, and it's absolutely wonderful to watch. Things like that, I think that there are lots of things that, from that perspective, where I think Apple's just nailed it. And again, there's lots of things that I'm not absolutely in love with, but really Apple's about hardware, isn't it? It's,
yeah,
you know, I could own a Mac and happily run Windows 10 on it. There's a battery issue, and that's one of the reasons I would consider a Mac over a PC. And I think that if you run the right programs, that does require some sacrificing. You might have to use Safari instead of Chrome. You can get such amazing battery life out of a Mac that that would be very appealing to me. And I really struggle with my Windows PCs in that regard. For a start, down to unpredictability. It's not so much that they don't last, it's that sometimes they last and sometimes they don't, and I don't know why. And that's very difficult, because if you're out and about on the road, so many times at trade shows, I've been sat next to, Verity from What Hi-Fi, and she's tapping away on her, Mac, happily, with loads of battery left, and I'm about to hurl my Dell over the crowds because it's already dead. I don't understand it, but anyway.
I can feel that pain. I definitely agree that there's, I mean, it's been many years, many, many years, in fact, since I've used a Windows machine as a laptop. In fact, I don't think I've had that since Windows XP. But definitely the physical aspect of mobile computing, at least, is definitely more important than the desktop for, I think, most people. Most people's computing requirements, which is why I've been an extremely happy buyer of the new 12-inch MacBook that is, the fanless design. And I get a good between 8 and 12 hours of usage out of that, depending on what I'm doing with it. Certainly, I go the entire day in the office and don't plug it in. Sometimes,
how do you find the speed of it? Is it powerful enough for what you need?
For what I need, it is, yes. And that's the weird thing, because it is definitely not a powerful machine, but it is powerful enough for browser-based stuff. If you're doing something that is, let's say, hosting a virtual machine, which is something that we need to do in our corporate environment, and so mostly that's just a terminal window sort of thing, not OS 10 terminal, just another computer screen on your screen, and it runs everything fine in the background. It multitasks very, very well. So, I've had very little issue with that at all. In fact, the last episode people heard of Text Message, I edited that on that machine on a plane.
I was going to ask if you'd ever edited the pod on a MacBook.
I have. Cool. I've done a couple of basic bits of video editing on Final Cut Pro to see if it worked, and it worked all right. Pretty nippy, but again, that's because Final Cut is quite an efficient video editor. And I did edit the entire podcast on a plane with no hiccups or problems whatsoever. And in addition, was watching iPlayer and some music, and I wrote a bunch of emails on the flight. So for me, it's worked out very nicely. But we're digressing a bit. I wanted to sort of condense some of our conclusions, because I think we agreed the rollout of Windows 10 was very good. I think we both agree that it's a very, very good OS and may indeed be the best in many years. But I think the other thing, that the point that you brought up, which I would definitely agree on, is that we are in an era of computing now where a good operating system is almost an invisible operating system. And OS X has been very good at being invisible for some time. And Windows 10 does a lot at being invisible most of the time in my usage. And by the sounds of it, your usage too. It's very good out of the box and gets out of the way, and it lets people use it quickly. And so I think we have to congratulate Microsoft and say well done. You've impressed a couple of Mac converts. You've impressed the public, and you've put it out for free, which is no bad thing.
Yeah.
At least free for some people. But let us know what you think. podcast@natelengson.com. Very excited and interested to hear your feedback. I don't want to necessarily encourage bad feedback, but a lot of what I've read about Windows 10 has broadly been positive, both within the sphere of journalists and critics, but also from the public. And so I am curious to hear if there's anybody listening who actually thinks Windows 10 is a step down. Is it worse than Windows 7 or Windows 8 for your use case? And if so, why? But general comments, of course, welcome as well. podcast@natelengson.com. It's time, Ian, to take it up a gear. In fact, it's time to take it to the top gear. as we take a ride through the Amazon for a prime steak dinner of news. How is that?
Good heavens. It was impressive, actually.
Yeah, it's pretty much off the top of my head as well. So, you know, at least within my own body, my own mind, I'm taking that as an even greater compliment and success. Yes, Top Gear is to return. Amazon has thrown enough wads of queens at James and Jeremy and, I almost said Brian May there, James May. and Top Gear...
And Richard Hammond.
Yes, after Jeremy Clarkson hit a producer and was fired and sort of ultimately caused the end of Top Gear in its, well, in its then current form for the BBC, it's been picked up by Amazon Prime. It's going to be an online-only series that starts in 2016. And
allegedly, I have a theory.
Yeah. Well, we'll come to your theory then in a second. But it is at least officially currently set to hit digital screens in 2016, and we'll come to hypothesize about how much money Amazon threw at these guys to get it, because they were almost certainly up against the likes of Netflix and Sky. You know, you could definitely see Sky Atlantic wanting to throw a huge amount of money, and maybe even companies like HBO as well. So let's start, Ian. I'll let you speak. What's your first take on Top Gear's return? And by all means, put on a tinfoil hat, which, by the way, I've read recently may amplify any thought reading experiments going on by the government. So it may be that
amazing.
They were shooting themselves in the foot. Yeah.
If all those people all these years have been putting on their tinfoil hats and actually been giving away secrets to the government,
exactly,
that would be devastating. So I read a story on the Financial Times that suggested that the price was $250 million. That would secure 36 episodes over 3 years, which sounds like a lot when you first say it, doesn't it? But actually, if you break it down on a sort of a per episode basis, it works out to what, like $7 million a show or something. I don't doubt that the main people are going to be earning a good amount of money out of it. And I suspect there'll be rights involved for the resale of any, you know. So, for example, Top Gear does very well on merchandising and DVD sales. I suspect Amazon will probably want to do a similar thing with that. And I assume that May, Clarkson, Hammond and the producer Andy Wilman will have set up a production company, particularly for making Top Gear. I imagine that they will have some revenue sharing agreement with Amazon so that they can continue to profit, you know, should Amazon want to sell the product, you know, in different ways. And I think that will happen later on down the line. For example, Dave in the UK buys Top Gear, and I suspect that they would be prepared to buy it off Amazon if they ever wanted to find a home for it on terrestrial TV. So, you know, it's a good move for those guys. It's probably the right amount of money. It gives them complete creative control and freedom, allows them to go back to doing what they love. But it also takes them out of the sort of cleverly managed sort of BBC environment where, you know, at least at the BBC, they were sort of watched like hawks, if you will. And that they were always very much of the opinion that you could do what you wanted as long as you apologised for it afterwards. And that worked for them there under the cover of the BBC. I wonder how much luck they're going to have with it when they're there, you know, they're doing it on their own auspices under their own production company. And Amazon just won't want to be involved in any of that, really. It's a big risk. But, of course, hopefully they've learned their lesson. They want to go and make a motoring show now and stop punching people and stop getting into trouble for saying silly racist things and stupid slurs that, you know, have no place in, you know, a reasonable modern TV programme.
The format that worked best for them is almost certainly the format that Amazon is expecting them to make for them. And so changing any aspect of it may not be in the interest of the show. I'm not saying that that they need to continue to be slurring and apologizing, but that slight that sort of slight unpredictable
I do know
edginess,
what you mean. Yes.
It's sort of a little bit of a part because it's all about the characters and their personalities, and for better or for worse, Clarkson in particular has a quite specific personality. And
yes,
that's
he's also smart, well, easily smart enough to say funny things that don't involve, you know, I don't know what their game was towards the end. I don't know whether they were bored at their BBC contract and wanted to get out of it anyway, but they were just doing stupid things. Like, it wasn't, there was nothing particularly clever about some of those things they said at the end, you know. It was sort of dismissed as a kind of like, oh, it's a bit of a mistake. But, you know, I suppose it doesn't really matter. But, yeah, I think they can be funny and edgy without just being offensive. The two are different. And that they sort of lost that, I think. They needed a break, I think, you know, a nice bit of time to think. And this has given them that.
Well, obviously, we're a tech show. More than a sort of a TV and culture show. So I want to talk a little bit about the fact that this is a real win for the cable-free, broadcast-free, online-only delivery method of mainstream television content. I mean, they're going to Amazon. I mean, we've kind of got used to seeing big, successful stuff coming out of Netflix. Orange is the New Black, House of Cards, that kind of thing. They've done Daredevil with Marvel, which I've heard is a big deal. And this is the first, really, for Amazon Prime. I mean, they piloted a whole bunch of shows not too long ago, but how many of them? I can't even think of a single one. I've not even watched House of Cards, but I know that it's incredibly good and popular.
Amazon's got some really good stuff, actually. Like, there's some really critically acclaimed things as well, and they have a really nice way of doing it as well. So their pilot run is a way for you to see one episode of everything, and then the ones that get voted popular will go on to be made into full series. It's a really cool way of producing a series, actually. And they've done the Philip K. Dick series. It's based if the Nazis hadn't lost the war, and how that impacted America. So that's quite an exciting show coming up.
It sounds quite a lot like the most recent Wolfenstein game. I'm curious for your view, though, about whether you think this could be the catalyst for Amazon Prime being lifted to the sort of the status of Netflix, which feels to me now like a real, I mean, my mum uses it. You know, I see adverts for it everywhere. You know, Netflix doesn't feel like a webby product. It just feels, it's Netflix. Like, everyone knows it, uses it. I mean, Windows, Amazon Prime, I don't know.
You've nailed it. You know, you've nailed it. You've absolutely nailed the problem. The problem with Amazon isn't the content and the fact that you didn't know about some of the stuff on there. And if you looked, you'd be shocked. It says to me, and exactly what I've said this to Amazon so many times, the problem is it's a confused brand with a poorly worded, you know, it's the way it works is a mess, frankly. Amazon restricts where the app can be used. So, for example, if you've got an Android phone, there's no Amazon, well, there is now, but you have to go through the Amazon app. So to watch video on an Android phone, there's no Amazon Prime Video app, as you'd expect. You have to get the Amazon app, and then you can watch video in a stupid web browser in the app. It is the worst user experience I've had in an app for a very, very long time.
Spin out the Amazon app and the Prime thing into, give it its own name, its own brand, a standalone app, and just get it on everything. Because that's what Netflix has done. It's on everything.
It could be called something other than Prime. They're obsessed with Prime. And I understand, because it's part of a product. You pay for Prime and you get all these brilliant services, and there are so many of them, and they're all so good. But I don't see why they don't necessarily have to be all called the same thing for that to work. You know, you could just call it Amazon Video. And, you know, you go on and they go, oh, yeah, good news, it's free because you've got Prime. And you're like, well, yeah, I've got Prime, this is great. As it stands at the moment, too many people are too confused by it. The app isn't widespread enough. It's not, the service isn't doesn't, Netflix is everywhere. You would struggle to find a device that doesn't have Netflix on it. And that was a really clever move, because it means that you can watch Netflix on everything. You know, that from an ancient tablet to, you know, a modern laptop. It's brilliant.
Well, I'm extremely pleased Top Gear's coming back. While I tend not to watch the regular episodes all the way through, I've never really been a massive fan of the star and the reasonably priced car aspect. But I love the specials. The specials to me are the reason that I wanted Top Gear to come back. Had the specials not been a part of the show when it was ended, then I don't think I would have mourned the loss of it as strongly as I did.
Are you, what are you more excited about? The return of the Top Gear on the BBC or the one that's going to be on Amazon?
Well, I think that the one is on Amazon, but that's because I'm not actually interested in cars. And I don't know if that says more about what Top Gear had become than...
no, I mean, there was no real secret about that. I mean, they always said it's not a car show, it's an entertainment show, and that's absolutely fine.
I think Top Gear will become a car show again on the BBC, particularly now that they know that Amazon is going to be probably going for the very mainstream kind of special type stuff.
I'm actually thrilled that there's going to be both. I think it's great. I think in some ways it's quite nice that the BBC will get a little bit of control back of Top Gear and maybe will make it into something that had become quite frustrating for me. You know, as someone who loves that show, some things about it I've become, you know, I really began to hate.
I'll pose the question to you then, sir. The question back to you. Which are you most looking forward to and why?
That's a really... I don't know. I think both, honestly. I think...
That's a cop-out.
Well, it is. I'm kind of more interested in the BBC one, I've got to say. That's funny, because you forced me to think about it. And I will absolutely watch both. I completely guarantee it. I mean, I love cars with all my heart. So I will be on both. I mean, I didn't watch Fifth Gear, but that was because I found it intolerable. But again, that, you know, it's been a very long time since we've had two car shows in the UK. It sounds ridiculous, doesn't it? Because there's so many cars and so many people that like cars, and we've only ever had one car show really that people really watched and talked about. So it'll be good to have two.
Well, let us know what you think, obviously, podcast@natelangson.com. Give us some thoughts, particularly on whether this would get you to care more about Amazon's Prime Instant Streaming On-Demand Video Non-Shop
so
Service.
So you don't know what it's called? You don't know what it's called, do you? No one knows what it's called.
I think it's Amazon Prime Instant Video.
Yeah, you think, but you don't know, do you? What's Netflix called?
Netflix.
Exactly.
Yeah, but we have the same problem with Google Play All Access, All Access Music.
It's called Prime Instant Video.
Yeah, it's a prime candidate for a name change. Let us know what you think. What would you call Amazon Prime Instant Video if you were in charge of it? Answers on a postcard, by which I mean an email to podcast@natelangson.com. Well, before we wrap up the show today, I want to get to a couple of notes that came in over the last couple of weeks onto the podcast@natelangson.com email account. I also want to take this opportunity to apologize for the lack of a show last week, but I have to say my travel schedule has been ridiculous recently, you know, to the extent of having to edit the show on a plane the other day because I didn't have time to physically edit it anywhere either side of the Atlantic. And last week, after that traveling with Ian's illness, we just had to take an impromptu break. So my apologies for that, but thank you for sticking with us and for continuing to give us 5-star reviews on iTunes. I've noticed a few more popping up. It's amazing. Last time I looked, we were on 75-star reviews, which warms my heart in a way that would I have been locked in the icy confines of the frozen Arctic tundra, I believe my heart would be warm enough to continue pumping that all-essential dark red fluid around my body.
And presumably you've now flown enough that you can actually take everyone who listens to this show on an around-the-world trip with your air miles.
Yes, that's TBC. We'll do
TBC.
That maybe for show 100. I'll fly a bunch of you out to Ealing. But a couple of emails that came in that I wanted to get to from a week ago. The first one comes from Richard, who says, something to discuss on the podcast that would be great for you to investigate further in the same vein as the ridiculousness that is the law on listening to music we have purchased on whatever device we choose being overturned. Would be the ripoff that is the PRS for music, who call up businesses like mine at least once per year to check if we have a license to listen to music. They have expanded upon this in recent years, continues Richard, and if your business has a TV set, brackets, we have one that is linked to an Apple TV for doing presentations, etc., then they think you should be paying for the right to broadcast music in your office. They are a complete joke. And from talking to a friend who has multiple albums released, they never see a penny from PRS. I made a stand recently and refused to pay as all of my staff listened to their own personal music collection, who are all nearly Apple Music converts now, on headphones, and it took a good 15 minutes of arguing with the idiotic woman on the phone that this did not constitute broadcasting music. My argument was that if indeed listening to your own music on your own headphones in a public or business space was broadcasting, then everyone who walks into a shop or airport or park would need a broadcast license. Clearly, the ridiculousness was lost on her, but either way, I refused to pay, and other businesses in my building are following suit. We refuse to be caught up in their music royalty scam any longer. Regards, Richard. Strong words.
Go, Richard.
I know particularly closely, but certainly PRS has a lot of stickers and a lot of windows.
Yeah, you're supposed to have it if you have a shop or a bar or something like that. I mean, I suppose it's fair enough if you have a bar and you play music. I've always found the office thing to be a bit objectionable, really. I mean, the thing about, you know, say if you're listening to a radio station or something, I mean, the radio station's paying royalties to the artist for that music anyway. So why do you have to then pay again? And apparently, you know, if the artists don't really get the money, which doesn't surprise me, to be honest. I mean, you know, knowing how labels work as I do, I'm not massively surprised by that. It just seems like a scam, doesn't it? So I would say, yeah, avoid that one as long as you possibly can.
Well, I'm very keen. This is not something I know a huge amount of, so I'm not going to comment particularly strongly on this, but I am going to encourage anybody listening, particularly if you work in the music industry, do you work for PRS? I'd be very keen to hear some comments anonymously, if required, that we could share to shed some light on what PRS is doing and why rules like this exist. Any comments, welcome. That is podcast@natelangson.com. And finally, we have another email that came in from a regular fan and I think ambassador for the Netherlands, for the show in the Netherlands, that is, Luke, who says, hi, Nate, the part of the podcast about UK music laws was spot on. That's quite nice to have from Luke, who doesn't live here. In the Netherlands, we've got a royalty system on blank media, and somehow external hard disk drives, iPods, and tablets are also taxed per gigabyte of storage space, he means there. The sole receiver of these royalties is the Dutch version of UK music, and I have a feeling that artists themselves receive little to no cash out of their pockets. I'm wondering if the public could get a detailed overview of the financial situation of these organizations and the amount of money they paid out to the artists. Still loving the podcast. Kind regards, Luke. I completely agree. I think these sorts of companies exist in every country. Certainly every country that has music is a part of their music distribution is a big part of their cultural.
And they absolutely should say where the money goes, shouldn't they? I mean, why wouldn't they? It would be interesting to know. And I think that if we're paying money for something, we'd sort of like to know that it's going where it should be going, which is the artist.
Yes, absolutely. I would be very keen, particularly, you know, the Netherlands would be great if we have people in the Netherlands or wider Europe and Scandinavia. But also, obviously, for our core listener base as well, the UK, any transparency or comment that we can pass about PRS would be or any of these royalty collection services, it'd be very interesting to have a more detailed comment on these emails from Richard and Luke that we've had today. Get yours in podcast@natelangson.com. Ian, it has been nothing short of a great pleasure, privilege, and indeed an honor to be broadcasting once again.
It's lovely to be back. I've missed you greatly, and I've missed our wonderful listeners as well and their kind words.
Yes, indeed. And those kind words can be left on iTunes to help us in our ranking mission. Thank you again, and we'll see you, all being well, I promise, in a week.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.